My next guest on the 1% Project is the dynamic Tarun Davta, Managing Director, Matrix Partners, India. In this insightful conversation about the evolution of the Indian venture capital ecosystem space, Tarun talks about his journey building Matrix Partners, the opportunities and the challenges he faced, the evolution of the Indian founder, are they improvising or innovating? What, in his view, is a world-changing or a disruptive idea or a pitch, and the influence of Chinese investments in the progression of the Indian entrepreneurship ecosystem. Welcome, Tarun, to the 1% Project.
Thank you for having me.
Has it been hard building Matrix India? When Matrix started off in India, venture capital was in a very nascent stage, right? Building trust and visibility with LPs, as well as getting the founders to understand the whole VC ecosystem would have been tough. And at the same time, there have been homegrown VCs, other international VCs also coming to the market. So how has that journey been?
Yeah, firstly, again, thank you for having me, Pritish. When you use the word, how hard has it been to build Matrix India? I think it's harder to answer that question because it's a labor of love in a way, right? And let me, in some ways, give you a little bit of a story behind it. So I think we internally, at least when Navneet, Shukram and I talk, we keep Matrix India in two chapters. Chapter one, as you probably know, the firm was founded in 2005-2006 by Avneesh and Rishi. They were the two original co-founders of Matrix India. And I think somewhere around 2015-16, Rishi had decided to move on to start his own growth stage fund. And that's when Avneesh, Shukram and I came together, got closer, almost think of it as the second birth of Matrix India, where we consider ourselves now co-founders of the second chapter of the journey. So I can talk about the first 10 years and I'll tell you what's different also in the second sort of avatar. So I think the first 10 years was really about just understanding the business. And I think for better or for worse, we understood the business by making way more mistakes than we should have. When we started, Avneesh was obviously the pioneer of the Indian internet economy in a way, where he was the founder of Bazi, sold Bazi to eBay. eBay became, Flipkart became Walmart. He's been the original sort of force behind some of these things. And because it was 2004-05, he had exited Bazi. His favorite joke is, I got all parts of the business plan right, except for one minor detail, that there were no internet users. Right? And so I think when Matrix India was first established, we didn't really make a lot of tech investments back then, internet investments, which is traditional VC. And we basically started with doing a lot more consumer. We did all sorts of random stuff as well in the middle, water and energy, and I don't know what not. But I would say consumer worked out well for us. We invested in a company called W, which went on to do really well. We made one gaming investment, which went on to do really well. We caught Daily Hunt in that era. This was well before mobile, hyper, local language news was even a term, but ended up catching Caught quicker, and they've had a little bit of an up and down journey, but obviously they're doing really well. And also caught a bunch of very interesting offline healthcare single specialty chains like Cloud9, Center for Sight, and a few others. And I think Vikram and me joined the firm around the 2012 timeline. And then both of us got promoted to partner around that 2015-ish kind of time frame, around the time Rishi had sort of started thinking about like outside meetings. And that is when I believe we actually got together and said, you know, there was this Merrymaker report that came out at 12, 13, I can't remember when, which showed that famous mobile internet or web sort of traffic intersecting. And then we said, hey, this is it. This is what we all have been waiting for. Finally, internet is happening. Obviously, I think 14, 15 was the time Jio really started aggressively going through their plans. And so we said, listen, version 2 of Matrix India will be the traditional venture firm that we all wanted to build but could never build because the market wasn't just there. And since then, obviously, did a lot of hard work to build our reputation. We were fortunate to catch Ola very early, fortunate to catch RazorPay very early, fortunate to catch Off Business, DealShare, you know, One Card. I mean, there's a lot of companies we caught in that sort of second half of Tracto. And I think the one thing that we were clear about is that, listen, the market is here and now. We could see that in our company. And it became easier to win deals, right? Because the simple thing we used to tell entrepreneurs whenever we found ourselves in a competitive deal situation is, hey guys, why don't you just look at our website, pick any company you want, just go talk to the founders. Don't ask us why you should take money from Matrix when you also have an offer from one of our competitors. And we said, listen, A, we're happy to do it together because we generally believe it takes a village. But B, you know what? If at all you want to pick one VC, we'll keep saying good things about ourselves, right? That's easy to do. But what is harder is to have entrepreneurs, both where things have gone well, but also where things haven't gone well, to say good things. And so we were pleasantly surprised. And I think it's one thing we're very proud of is our founder NPS tends to be very high. And it's and we can talk more about it through the conversation. But I do believe, given that a lot of us come from an entrepreneurial background, Avnish was an entrepreneur, I was an entrepreneur, Vikram worked at an early stage startup before he started. A bunch of us come from that background. I do believe that it shows in our style of engagement with these founders. And they appreciate it and they reciprocate it. And they generally say it's great to get Matrix very early because a lot of the you know stuff that is required at early stage company building, Matrix is well placed to contribute towards. I would say the hardest thing for us, honestly, it's not been the LPs. It's not been raising funding and raising, getting money into India. I think, honestly, we benefit from the global heritage in that sense. It's not been finding the best companies to invest in. I think, obviously, we could have done much better. We have our own market share within the successful ones, right? I think it's just been two things, yeah. One is the internet opportunity in India has always been about, oh, the next 10 years will be different. And when you keep telling yourself that from 2005 to 2010 to 2015, finally now in 2020, it looks like, okay, now it's finally here, yeah. Right? We can see yes. Flipkart is going to IPO and Zomato is IPOing and Delivery may IPO and Nykaa may IPO and a bunch of others, right? And we're seeing it in our companies, right? Our companies, the depth of the market for the first time is visible because we're seeing it in the metrics of our companies, right?
Yeah.
These companies are growing faster at a much higher scale. Right, which kind of goes to show that the depth is really there. So it's honestly, it's not even been in finding good investments. I think the single biggest thing has been in really making sure that, A, you keep the faith and you keep the faith of those around you, saying that, hey, listen, it's happening. It's just because I told you 5 years ago, it's going to happen in 10 years and it did happen, doesn't mean, you know, the next 10 years also won't happen. So I think, honestly, we feel it. And now, end of the day, the cycle completes when you finish your IPO journey. And so I think India will see 10 to 15 high-quality IPOs in the next 12 months. So I think that has been clearly one thing where there have been a lot of naysayers, there have been a lot of doubters, and just staying true to your conviction that this is coming and I'm not delusional, I would say has been one thing. Second is, I think India as an ecosystem is very young, right? We are, for the first time, seeing a set of repeat founders. For the first time, angels are seeing money and are seeing exits starting to happen. There aren't experienced VCs, right? Like none of us have like seen multiple cycles of investing in a company, helping it grow, take it to exit. And so a lot of us are learning lessons for the first time. And in that, finding people and building a team that is as focused, as passionate, as convinced in the opportunity. And I'm not just saying for Matrix, right? Like it's portfolio companies also. If you ask any entrepreneur, what's your number one problem? They'll say, I just wish I could hire better people and hire faster. And I would say some version of that is something that I consider myself as an entrepreneur at Matrix India. And I think we would say the same. That's been one of the harder things for us. But overall, it's been a fantastic journey. I would not be doing anything else if not for this. It's a privilege to do what we do. It's a privilege to work with extremely passionate, extremely intelligent entrepreneurs who are looking to change the world and create impact. And we are in the fortunate position where we get a ringside view into their journey. Right? And so it's very gratifying.
I think you touched upon a number of things. One thing I really want you to help double click is that you talked about brand building. And brand building when, as you mentioned, the journey has been from 5 years to 10 years and now it has arrived. So how critical has that been for you and how difficult has that been?
No, like I said, I think it's just been a test of conviction here. I remember there is I won't name the investor, but probably one of the most successful investors in internet, or actually global internet. I remember talking to him once and I asked him saying that, hey, you make it look very easy. You've got all the biggest unicorns in India. You've got all the biggest unicorns globally. Like, what's your secret? And he said, Tarun, the best companies have tested my conviction. Not once, not twice, but multiple times. And some of my biggest successes are in companies where multiple times we've looked at less than 30 days of cash left in the company. And miraculously, the founder has pulled off a financing round or whatever. And so I think it's easy to say it when it's after it's happened, but when you're going through it, it's a real test of conviction. And so I think obviously everybody goes through those moments. I would say for me, like I would go back and just say it's a journey where all of us combined are learning, right? The angels are learning, the entrepreneurs are learning, you know, co-investors are learning to work with each other. Employees are finally valuing equity. Like till a year ago, I don't think any employee in India had, or maybe a couple of years ago, I don't think there was a meaningful chunk of people who really valued ESOPs. So in India, it was all about, oh, give me a 30% pay hike. Oh, and now, okay, throw in a few options because I need to negotiate on everything. Right? And so it was never a, hey, if you're giving me real equity in your company, what's the trade-off between the right level of ownership versus the right level of cash flow for lifestyle or whatever it is, right? And I think today, finally, people are understanding because a lot of companies, and I'm sure you read this in the news recently, not only companies that are exiting, but companies at Series C onwards have started creating large ESOP pools, have started doing buybacks, a small amount, whatever it may be, right? But in every round, right, it just makes it real. It's not like some small paper that I signed when I joined the company and never to see it again. Like the day I know that every single option is worth real dollars, that's when it starts becoming real. And so I think just overall seeing that maturity in the ecosystem has been a journey, and it's finally great to be where we are.
Great. So I think that leads me to asking, is investing more exciting or exits?
Do you like to put money or take out money? No, but I think it's hard to separate the two. Honestly, I think the two go hand in hand. It is a cycle. Obviously, for a lot of us, large part of our time has gone in investing. It's a long feedback loop business, right? Like, it's not that you invest today and you can exit in 1, 2, 3 years, right? This is a 5 if you're really lucky, but more likely a 10-year plus journey, especially in India. And maybe it's closer to 12, 13 years in India. 5 or 6 it started. Or 8, I can't remember. Yeah. It's 2021 is going IPO, right? And the reality is that it is, I don't know the exact date, but I know it's maybe 12 years or thereabouts. And so I think the reality is that the true rewiring, you know, VC is a pattern matching business. For you to close the loop, you need to go through a cycle where you see the value creation and the value unlocking. Yes, there are markers along the way to know that a company is doing well, but the proof is in the pudding. And so the reality is it's only when you exit do you A, build enough self-confidence to say, hey, yes, this whole thing is somewhere the loop closes and, you know, it starts making sense. So I would say, you know, exit, it's, we've had a few of those at Matrix India, and it's always a big booster to, you know, send back money to your investors, because finally you can look them in the eye and say, hey, you know what we've been telling you since so many years is actually coming true. But I truly enjoy the investing business. Like finding an entrepreneur that you're excited to partner with, somebody that you share the vision with, somebody whose dream you can relate to, somebody who's solving a problem that you think is a problem worthy of solving. And we don't do too many of these personally. As a fund, we'll do 15, 20 investments a year. Personally, I might be associated with 2, 3, maybe 4 at most a year, right? And so it doesn't happen as often as people think. And so there are really 3 or 4 people that you're really pounding the table for every year and saying, hey, I want to be in business with, you know, him or her. And so I truly enjoy that. Not obviously all of them will go the way you want. And that's part of the journey as well. And over time, you just learn to deal with the ones that don't work. Initially, you end up taking it very personally. Initially, you end up like being defensive and not really trying to objectively see, hey, what really went wrong? What could I have done differently as an investor, as a board member? But over time, I think you realize that every such investment is an opportunity for you to learn and narrow the pattern of what you think would be a successful investment going forward. And so I think these are all important data points. And the other tough part, which a lot of people in the VC business know, the reality is your lemon's always right, which is the problem in VC, where you make a bunch of investments in your first 2, 3, 4 years. And obviously the ones that don't work in very early, they run out of cash, co-founder issues, company doesn't work, they don't get to PMF. And so it almost seems period of time that, oh my God, like I really suck at it. And every company around you is like going belly up. But then there's, if you're lucky and if you're fortunate, there's always hopefully a couple of them that are tracking, that are doing well, that have some external markers of success, that are raising larger financing at higher prices than what you invested in. And I think it's when those go on to create real material value and exit, that's when the real sort of loop completes, right? But yeah, I would say, I don't know if I answered your question. It's hard to pick either or, but I think the whole process in itself is it's hard to separate the two.
No, I agree. I think both of them are a part of the whole process. And I think you touched upon a great point again, that you the more you become unemotional about your decisions in investing, I think you become a better investor.
Yeah.
And you are able to actually clearly
and it's easier said than done, right? It's much easier said than done. Because all these biases are internal to each person. There's a reason why it's called a blind spot. Right? You just can't see it. It may be people around you and people who've seen the world more than you can see it, that you're going through that bias, but it's not visible to you at that point in time.
Yeah, absolutely. So now you probably would have gone through hundreds, if not thousands, of decks and founders or pitches. How have you seen the Indian founder evolving over these last 10 to 15 years?
Yeah, it has been, if I look back, that has been one of the most positive things that has happened in the last decade. See, again, it goes back to the maturation of the ecosystem, right? If you look at Silicon Valley, if you look at China, right? What really happened there? There was an ecosystem built. There were a few successful companies. In the US, it was Cisco and Juniper Networks and a bunch of these companies, which started with sort of hardware companies and became software companies. And over time, the whole ecosystem evolved. Right? But what happened in that is there were a lot of people who learned the trick of building high growth startups. And the playbook is different. It operates very different from a typical traditional, you know, company. And so if you were in the L-1, L-2 layers, if you were part of an early stage, early founding, like early team at a startup, and you were part of that success, you just learned tricks that nobody else knew. And then some of those people went on to start other companies. Some of those people went on to become CXOs at some other companies. And that's how overall the sort of skill level or the knowledge level or the, you know, of the overall ecosystem grew, right? Same thing in China. If you see most of the current unicorn founders in China have spent some time at Alibaba, Baidu. In India, guess what? Till 2, 3, 4 years ago, there weren't too many like real scaled successes. And so it's only now where people who are ex-Flipkart, ex-Paytm, ex-Urban Company, ex-Amazon, finally, these are the people who are either taking up key leadership positions at some of the younger startups or are starting up. And I think to me, that has been the biggest change, right? I remember the decks and I remember the pitches that we used to hear in early days when I had joined, and some of them that I hear today. It's chalk and cheese. It's chalk and cheese. People are just better prepared. People are just more aware. And I'm sure founders say that about investors, saying that, hey, you know what? The kind of people I used to go and pitch to 10 years ago and the kind of people I pitch to today is just so different, right? Because we didn't know which questions to ask. We didn't know like how to think about some of these early stage disruptive ideas. We didn't know, like, I remember very well Ola, you know, pitch. One of the biggest questions was like, hey, can I see a driver like literally sitting with a mobile phone and locked into an app and taking a booking? And none of us could imagine that future. And the whole country changed, right? Every driver had that. And so I think people have more patterns that they can match to now. And so I think overall, there's a lot more, just basically the quality of analytics. You look at the quality of company that like, companies in China do and the kind of analytics they set up. And I remember people, like for me, it's just a very small thing. When we talk about companies in India, generally they say, oh, I'm growing 3x year on year, or I'm growing whatever, 15% month on month, whatever it may be, right? I went to China, companies were talking about, here's my week on week growth. It's a very small thing. It's a very small nuance. But suddenly you're like, okay, these people actually measure weekly growth. I had never thought of that, right? Again, it's not that companies in India weren't growing week to week. It's just the mindset was different, saying that, hey, the opportunity is so large, like you should be measuring every week how much you're growing. And that's how that culture flows top down. And just knowing what to measure and knowing what are the things that are important, knowing which metrics are vanity and which ones can be game, knowing which metrics are less easy to game and stuff like that. All of that is stuff that, you know, overall as an ecosystem, I think we've learned. And so I would say the quality of pitches we see is significantly better. It's because people have been around the block a few times. People have made the rookie mistakes that were there to be made. It's not that there aren't other mistakes to be made. Yes, people will keep seeing mistakes happening, but we're not playing gully cricket anymore. I think this is, people are now finally, it feels like it's real. Global investors are benchmarking these startups to the best startups in the world, are, you know, coming in with, you know, as much money and as much conviction as they are backing global startups. Finally, that it's real and it'll only get better from there.
Yeah. I think there are two things associated to this. One, among all these pitches and the evolution, when do you see or what kind of things in a pitch or in an idea makes you think that this is disruptive? Because a lot of ideas that come across may have a similar nuance, an extra layer. But when do you figure that there is a disruption in this idea and this can really change the way the consumer uses or thinks about using a product or a service?
Yeah, I'm trying to think about the best way to answer that question, and I was trying to see if there are any anecdotes. I think the most disruptive ideas are the ones that are also the easiest to dismiss. And I'll give you an example. Going back to Ola, and a lot of people don't know this, right? But Ola was not a copy of Uber. Ola was, and we were there when Babish was, had just raised a Series A round. This was just two entrepreneurs in different parts of the world looking at the mobile phone and looking at the smartphone and then looking at the state of the streets and saying, hey, you know what? There's got to be a better way for me to go from point A to point B. And it happened, obviously, that Uber was maybe a year and a half ahead of Ola. And obviously, because of a much larger domestic market, scaled up much more rapidly early on. And over time, obviously, we all understood what Uber is. And they were, by the way, black cab, right? They weren't even like their typical local taxi, whatever it is. And I remember initially people were just so dismissive. I remember one of the questions in our, what people called IC meeting. We don't call it IC meeting, it's our team meeting. But I remember when Bhavesh had come to pitch, his app screen was just a map with a simple button saying book now. And I remember somebody saying, this is your app? Like it's got one button? Like how hard can this be to build? Right?
Yeah.
And people weren't like, who's going to see, look at cabs moving around in an app and like on a map and like this big book. It sounded really disruptive at that time. But it also was very easy to dismiss, saying that, boss, this guy is like delusional. And if you see housing, they had that same interface for home search. And if you see, so I would say, I remember sitting in one of the early pitches of, and it's a miss for us, there's a company called ShareChat. And yes. I remember, and we'll talk about a couple of new ones also. And I remember when we met Fareed, you know, fantastic team. A lot of us were like, who's sending these good morning, good evening messages? Like, why are people sending this every day, every morning, multiple times a day? And then you just, that's when, and it's very easy to dismiss, right? Especially as a urban Indian, you know, who's not necessarily the right demographic. It's very easy to be dismissive of this stuff and say, hey, you know what, like this makes no sense. And then, oh, it makes sense, but you know what, it's not going to be large. Oh, you know what, it's going to be large, but you know what, how will they monetize, right? At every stage, there is a new way to dismiss it. But I would say some of those were disruptive at their time. I mean, to go back to TikTok, right? For the longest time, people were like, who's going to look at teenagers dancing like mindlessly on the screen for 30 seconds, right? And suddenly we have the US government and the president like deciding whether it should be allowed to operate or not. Right. And so I would say even the recent ones, there's a couple, I'll name both of them. Again, for one reason or the other, we aren't in either. There's a company called Kutum, which is a social network for communities. Right. So if you're a Jat or if you're a whatever, some particular Jain community within, now a lot of people are like, why do I need this? Like, how are you going to build a business around it? And I don't know how they're doing now, but from what I heard in the middle, they were doing extremely well. There's a company called Animal Now, which is used for cattle trading, believe it or not. So it's a marketplace for farmers to buy and sell cattle. Right?
Didn't know.
Now, the first time, like a lot of these ideas just sound silly, right? Which farmer is going to be sitting and buying cattle on a mobile phone with a click of a button? Right? And especially in India. And you will not believe how well some of these companies are doing. Mm. And so I would say same thing with like there's one in our portfolio called Dukan, which is basically in some ways a Shopify for emerging markets, right? Mobile first, Shopify for emerging markets. Now, till the pandemic came, nobody really believed that small store owners will want to have a digital presence where they can upload the catalog and engage their regular customers to just buy using, you know, the online link. Today, like millions of stores that have been created and people are using it to place orders and get deliveries. They've integrated with payment providers and logistic providers, and we can see it getting built. It's still obviously very early days, and there's 100 reasons it may not work, but there's, you know, a lot of reasons it will work. And so I think a lot of ideas that people do, I think the most disruptive ones are the ones that you just, for whatever reason, can't see and will dismiss. But I've just learned from painful experience over time that those are the ones you should pay attention to.
Great. I think you brought up two points. One, foreign investments, and the second one, ShareChat. ShareChat recently raised, I think, from China as well, a good amount of money. And the one thing that I would really like your views on is how has, maybe not very recently, but in the last few years, the Chinese investment into the Indian ecosystem, how has that helped or disrupted the evolution of the entrepreneur as well as the tech landscape in India?
Yeah, I think they're looking for a known story, right? So the benefit that I think US and Chinese investors have when they're looking at Indian companies, very often they have the benefit of hindsight. And so they're able to look at a company and point it to another company that they've funded in China, where they have a very unique insight into what worked. They have a very unique insight into the kind of team and entrepreneur it took to make that model work. And they have a very unique insight into potential sort of air pockets that the company will hit over time. And so they're able to help guide the company fairly well through that. And so I think especially a lot of these social models, content models, I don't think there were a lot of either Indian or US funds that were willing to back, at least at the very early stages. And so I think the Chinese investors definitely played a role in opening up our minds towards, hey, these could be very interesting businesses. And Chinese investors have made truckloads of money on TikTok and Kuaishou. And so they are coming from, like, how are you not able to see this, right? We've seen how insanely profitable these companies can be. And there are even others, right? Like Beagle, I know a lot of us don't use it and don't want to talk about it, but that was insanely profitable for, you know, the company. And so there are a lot of these content, live streaming, live video kind of models, which just worked really well in China. And I know in India, we haven't seen that kind of tipping economy as yet, but it's coming. There are already proxies towards that in multiple segments that we see, and it's going to happen sooner than later. So I think, A, they've opened our minds to some models that maybe we were being more dismissive of than we should have been. The second is, I think, because they've also seen how large these companies can get, I think they've also been fairly aggressive in giving good valuations, writing larger checks than what, and they're willing to tolerate losses for a longer time, right? In a content company, for example, it could be like 5 years before you have your first dollar of revenue. It's probably 10 years before you have any meaningful revenue coming in. I don't know until now if a lot of Indian investors would have had the wherewithal to say, hey, I'm going to fund this for 10 years. It's fine. Don't monitor. But in these kind of businesses, you have to take that kind of outlook. And so you need to have that deep-pocketed investor who's willing to underwrite that longer journey towards revenue.
Actually, you touch upon a very good point. I was speaking to another friend of mine. He's a VC in Europe. And when he speaks to LPs in the European context 5 years ago, what he figured that the second and third, or rather the seventh or eighth generation, who are the LPs, they were slightly skeptical in being venture capitalists or putting money there because they are with the mindset of preservation of wealth. But when he looked at the US market and the China market, the second and third generation, because they were closer to the money creation, they were more proactive towards the VC fund. And how do you see that evolving in India?
That's an interesting point you make. China, by the way, there's a lot of local money now, right? Like most Chinese funds. Yes. Don't even need to depend on like US LPs anymore. If they don't want to raise, there's probably 10x more money, 10x more local money now available. And I think it's starting to happen in India. I don't know if you're familiar with IIFL. I was just talking to one of their guys yesterday. They've raised late stage private pre-IPO funds. There's insane amount of desire and interest from HNI and family offices in India, and obviously in the AIF structure. So I think it's changing. I wouldn't be, some of our peer funds have raised substantial amounts of money from India, so have we. I think, I don't know about a few funds, but like whether it's A91 or whether it's some of the smaller C-stage funds, many of them are largely Indian and domestic LPs also. So I think it's changing. There is definitely a lot of interest. A lot of the disbelief, a lot of the dismissive nature of, oh my God, these companies will never make money. This is a bubble. This is a valuation bubble. These companies are like, how are investors giving so much valuation to these companies when they are loss-making? I think there is more awareness and education happening that technology companies will burn more than what most normal people can fathom in the early years. But because of the scalability of these businesses, they can generate significantly higher ROIC over time. Assuming the business model is working, they can generate significantly higher and at a much higher scale than was earlier seen as being possible. And I think that recognition is happening. And so there is definitely a lot of openness to now exploring this as an asset class in India.
So would you say that the Indian founder is improvising or innovating?
Yeah, I don't know. Everyone will have a different definition of the term. But let me ask you this, right? In your mind, is Flipkart an innovation or an improvisation? Let me ask you this question. Sorry.
If I nuance it, I think it is an innovation because every market, I personally don't think that what people say copying, right, is a bad thing. But unless and until that copying does not have the nuance for your own market, which actually is the innovation,
correct,
it won't work.
Yeah.
Right? For your customer base.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, but see, by that definition, after I remember first marketplace, I mean, doesn't mean every marketplace in the world, online marketplace is a copy. No, it's not. Does it mean that every, commerce company is the same? No, it's not. Does it mean every social company is the same? No, it's not, right? There's always a lot of innovation that that happens on the ground. And we've been part of some of these stories, right? Think of it, right? Who pioneered COD in India? It was Flipkart, right? If it wasn't for Flipkart, the basic thing that in India, the biggest, one of the biggest, and it continues to be today, even today, 60% is COD. Despite of all the leaps and bounds we've made, as a country with, cards and UPI and everything, the reality is it's still a 60% e-commerce business around whichever vertical give or take. And so I would say, the and a lot of people don't understand this, right? The difference between a US and a China and an India. In the US, e-commerce was built on top of existing supply chains in several cases. China, like the largest retailer in the US, was the offline sort of supermarkets for the longest time. Malls and these like super stores like Walmart and stuff like that. They had built massively large-scale national supply chains. Same thing with China, which is the biggest supply chain built in. The cab networks, Didi, were built on top of existing cab inventory to begin with. Obviously, UberX came and then it expanded the market even further. But these were cab aggregation plays of existing cabs. Ola built the cab network. It didn't just aggregate it. It built the cab. Yeah. It built 500. It brought on 500,000 additional cabs onto the network, right? It wasn't just a simple aggregation play. And I think if you go vertical by vertical, you will see the story playing out. That in India, we talk about this whole leapfrogging thing, where we leapfrogged. We basically went from fixed line to wireless. There was no wired line or whatever it is. We straight leapfrogged to mobile internet and smartphones. We didn't have the PC revolution or whatever it is. So I think in India, the other level of leapfrogging that I see is that companies and industries are being created in parallel to the internet distribution of those industries is happening. It's not that the internet aggregation of those industries is happening as a second step. It's all happening at the same time. And if that's not innovation, what is it? Imagine building an industry and building the plumbing while at the same time thinking about, CAC, online customer acquisition, distribution, retention, engagement. These are not simple things to solve for, right? And even in India, I remember when us and Babish used to have this debate for the longest time. In Uber today, when you book an app, right, when you book a cab, it shows you for the longest time, it'll keep clocking and saying, looking for a cab, matching you with a cab, blah, 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 right? In Ola, you click book, instantly you get assigned a cab. Do you know why that happens? Because in Ola, in India, they assign a booking to a cab driver. It's not sent as a poll to the 10 drivers in the area and the one who first clicks accept gets that booking, which is why in Uber, it clocks for those 30 seconds because a ping has gone out to the drivers in your vicinity and now one of them will accept it. In Ola, they said, listen, I need to ensure that I get threshold earnings for every driver because that's the only way these drivers will stick to my platform. If I don't give threshold earnings to a particular driver, I will likely not be able to, these drivers will churn out. Worse, the customer is waiting. That 30 seconds wait time is a pain. And so I think it's these are all very small product nuances, but they have a very big effect on how your marketplace develops.
You initially also talked about that you also do some personal investments, right? So in that space, when you look at a pitch, so when are the three main segments? When you talk about team, product, and market size, what do you look for in these specific areas when you're listening to a pitch or going through a deck?
Yeah, like you said, everybody is looking at some combination of team, business model, and market opportunity. I think at the stage at which we invest, it's team and market opportunity, which is just supremely more important than anything else. generally the state at which we invest, there is almost never revenue. In many cases, there is almost never a product also. So as the market gets more competitive, all of us are going earlier and earlier because we want to get into business with the best founders. And so I would say, and I don't want to put a percentage to it, there are firms which are definitely more market first, right? And very publicly so, where they say market trumps, great market, bad founder, market wins. Great market, great founder, magic happens. And bad market, great founder, nothing happened. And maybe some version of that is true, by the way. But I also believe somewhere that market in a country as complex as India, where on the surface, everything looks like a large market. But when you drill deep and you start excluding all the complications and all the friction points, the market may also look too narrow and too small when you adjust to all the realities of like doing business in India and licensing and all the 100 things, right? And so I think in India, it takes a special entrepreneur to pierce through the market very sharply, find that thin edge of the wedge to penetrate the market. And then the market can expand as much as the entrepreneur wants it to expand. And so I would just say we've fallen into this trap very often where we found a great entrepreneur and we've analyzed ourselves out of the investment saying it's a small market. And all of a sudden, you just see that the entrepreneur has just kept building around the circumference and basically kept expanding TAM. And they've added new services, new products, new geographies. And all of a sudden, you're like, oh my God, what was I thinking? Why did I just not bet on this individual the moment I knew that they were exceptional, right? And so at Matrix, the philosophy, we believe founders first. And when I say founders first, I think of that as an investing philosophy, which is over all else, I will invest in the best founders. I may not believe in the market. I may not understand the business and how the company will make money. But at the stage at which I invest, the most important thing is find exceptional people and just back them and be on the journey with them. They are smart enough to figure it out.
Following that response, any of the businesses of one founder that who pitched to you so clearly, probably did a back of envelope mathematics or whatever, and you just said, this is it. And it really worked out.
Many. I'll start with an offline company example. This is a company that my partner Vikram invested in. It's a company called Exceptional Entrepreneur. I don't think I've met an entrepreneur who understands his business as well as his name is Lakshmipati. We call him Pati. I don't think anyone understands his business better than Mr. Pati. His clarity of thought, his conviction on the model, his nuanced insights on every aspect of the model. It was just so crisp that every statement he speaks is a blinding insight. And it was almost clear in that first meeting when he came and pitched us saying, "What? Just write the check. Don't overthink this." I'll give another example. Razorpay. Razorpay is another example of that. That's a company we funded on video. It was a seed check. They were still at YC, met the founders. The way they were thinking of building our payment solution was vastly different from anything else that we had seen or heard, and we took that bet. Recent times, I would say, take, for example, a Deal Share or a Stanza in both of these companies I'm involved in. I think it was very apparent to us in the first meeting. Like the first time we met the guys, we were like, okay, nobody understands the market better than these guys. Nobody's thinking about this the right way. We've met a lot of companies. And I've also learned one thing. An entrepreneur who changes, if you go in negatively predisposed into a meeting with the market, about the market, about the opportunity. And if an entrepreneur is successful in changing your mind in that one meeting, that's generally the entrepreneur you want to back. Because if somebody can come and turn around weeks and months of a predisposed view that you have, A, they know something that you don't know. And B, they've been successful at changing your view with their knowledge or their insights of that segment. And so very often, I think for me, the most enjoyable meetings are the ones where everybody's looked at the student housing market. It's bloody messy. It's very hard to make money. It's very hard to scale. Too many service quality issues. Real estate at a local level is just a pain to deal with. There's too many sort of elements that you don't want to, deal with on a day-to-day basis. Online grocery, right? Like multiple companies have tried. They've burnt money hand over fist in trying to get to what a scale they've gotten. There's still many of these companies in several cities haven't been able to make the business model work. And then we saw the Deal Share guys and they were like, listen, you know what? I'm 5x more capital efficient than any other e-commerce company in India. And the metrics showed it. And then when you spend time with them to understand how they had broken out the business model that led to this 5x sort of improvement over any other commerce company, it was just very apparent that these guys have just gone so deep in their understanding of the Indian consumer and what they need, and also the delivery model to make the economics work at that sort of order size. We'd never heard that in with other people. And so I think it's happened more than once.
Before we get into the exciting part of rapid fire, my question to you would be, how much of venture investing is gut feeling versus analytics?
I think the answer is different for each person. I tend to be much more intuitive about the bets I want to take. But I don't think it's either or again, right? Like, I think everybody who's instinctive over time learns from the mistakes and starts applying analytical models to take away the right learnings from the ones that didn't work and starts hopefully complementing it with a deeper analysis of the business, of the opportunity and stuff like that. And I think the most analytical ones will miss some of the biggest ones out there, because they're you get into analysis paralysis, you're looking for too much data, you may end up missing the forest for the trees. You have an exceptional entrepreneur in front of you, but you have like too much data that you're analyzing, and you may just not see it, right? And so I think, and we've seen versions of both VCs, right? I'm probably in the former category where I backed more on instinct and then realized that more analysis would have help me prevent, you know, some mistakes that I've made. At the same time, I've seen people who are extremely good at analyzing things top down, but they just can't spot an entrepreneur. And I think the best ones over time learn to do both and find that right balance.
So now we're going to get into a rapid fire. One word, one sentence.
Do I get a hamper or no?
Yes, you do. But not the current Johar one.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
The toughest thing about your job.
I won't say saying no to entrepreneurs. I think that's a very lame cop-out. I think the toughest one is to be proven wrong more often than you're proven right.
One book or a blog that has influenced you the most, personally and professionally?
So professionally, one of the books that I think is very relevant to our business is a book called Super Forecasting. I think at some level, every investor is forecasting 5 to 10 years out. And I think you're forecasting about an individual and how they will grow. You're forecasting about a market, whatever it may be. So I think that book is very instructive. At a personal level, I've been reading this book and I just finished reading it called The 5 AM Club. And I think some of the lessons from that are just truly mind opening.
Brilliant. Your most favorite superhero?
I don't have one. And so I'll probably Spider-Man, because A, my son loves him, and B, he flies.
It was a pleasure having you on the 1% Project.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for the great questions.
My three key takeaways from this conversation are, number one, every investment is an opportunity for you to learn and narrow down your investment pattern so you can make better investments in the future. Number two, the most disruptive ideas are the ones which are easiest to dismiss. And number three, entrepreneurs who can change your mind, especially about an industry that you have a negative predisposed notion about, are the ones you want to back.